England can be persistently damp and gloomy. It's an island, often estranged from the body of Europe and remote from America. English people can seem a little gloomy and remote themselves, which may be why they have such accomplished imaginations. And the English imagination has helped shape Shakespeare, Chaucer, Wordsworth, Austen, Milton, Pinter, Osborne, Gilbert and Sullivan, Benjamin Britten, Auden, Peter Sellers, Monty Python, and Mick Jagger. Peter Aykroyd, who wrote the recent best-selling London, The Biography, has written a new book about the empire of the English imagination. It's called Albion, England's ancient name. Albion, the origins of the English imagination. Peter Aykroyd joins us from the studios of the BBC in London. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
And whatever you're talking about in this book, if you're talking about the English imagination in song, in gardening, in literature, in theater, it seems to come back to a couple of words, including inclusive and absorbent.
Certainly, the absorbent or assimilative nature of the English imagination is something I wanted to emphasize as much as possible. For me, Englishness is not so much a specific identity or set of attitudes or principles, but rather the principle of assimilation itself. Half the strength of the English culture, English art, English literature is derived from, say, continental models. Translation has always been a particularly English art. The gift which the English have is to appropriate the best of other cultures and then somehow domesticate it, turn it into a particularly English product.
How much of that relates to the quality of English itself, this language that has developed and really, I think we can fairly say, perhaps over the 20th century, developed into a kind of what Esperanto was supposed to be?
It has become a world language, and I think it's become a world language because of its inclusiveness. From the beginning, it was made up from a variety of different elements, Saxon, Latin, French, Scandinavian, Celtic. It's always been a mélange of different words, different syllables, different grammar and different syntax. It's always been a heterogeneous medium, and I think it's that protean quality of the language which has allowed it to be so successful in the present day. But it's also that protean nature of the language which has helped shape English fiction or English poetry itself. It's by being so heterogeneous in itself that it's encouraged heterogeneity in the products of the English language.
You have a wonderful chapter on Shakespeare, and I'm going to take the liberty of beginning to trace a lot of this recognition of the quality of English imagination back to Shakespeare. You write about the fact that so many of his plays, well, let me quote your own words, "It lies in his mingling of high and low, king and fool, prince and gravedigger, commander and soldier, scholar and buffoon." This signature that he had of writing both about monarchs and buffoons.
Yeah, that's an important part of his genius, but it wasn't something which he originated. It's a quality which has been what you might call endemic in English writing from the earliest periods.
I do have to talk to you about gardening. There's something about the passion that so many Britons can have for gardening that suggests something to you about the English imagination as well.
Yeah, it's to do, I think, partly with a sense of privacy. The fact of a garden suggests a house, and the pattern of English development has always been the individual family house with its own garden attached to it. Mm-hmm. And this kind of defensiveness, this protectiveness, this sense of privacy is one that can be observed in all phases of English life.
At the same time, I think you make bold enough to suggest that sensual arousal is part of it too.
Yes, in a sort of oblique and indirect way. It's, as it were, a displacement of sensuality or sexuality, if you want to put it that way. And that's another interesting, if perhaps less relevant, aspect of the English mind, the English culture, English imagination, is the way in which sex is never treated head-on. It's treated as farcical or pantomimic. The history of the dirty joke has a long lineage going right back to the earliest mystery plays. The history of misogynism, of anti-feminism, for want of a better phrase, mm-hmm. also has a very long history in English life. And I think it's to do with an English distaste for or embarrassment about sexuality in general.
What about an artist like Chaucer? Is it not true that the whole definition of what we consider to be blue humor, for example, or blue references, has a way of changing from century to century and generation to generation?
It doesn't change that much. If you read the Fabliau in the Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, mm-hmm. it's the same slightly embarrassed and furtive and jokey attitude towards sexuality. But Chaucer's interesting in another guise, too, because in a sense he has become the quintessential English writer. His detachment from his writing, his embarrassment, his refusal to take himself seriously, mm-hmm. his parody of learning, all these features of his life and work have become, as it were, quintessential virtues to which other writers, with which other writers have associated themselves. Mm-hmm. Chesterton once said that if you looked at England, you would see the genial smiling face of Chaucer beaming out from it. And although that, of course, is a ridiculous overstatement, there is a sense in which Chaucer is the progenitor of the English preference for understatement mm-hmm. and for, how can I put it, lack of seriousness.
Mr. Aykroyd, nice talking to you again.
That's a pleasure.
Peter Aykroyd, his most recent book is Albion, The Origins of the English Imagination.